Good morning. I'll just help with you with your aversion to the front row. I'll just move a little closer. As you think about wedding vows, there are things that we say that in and of themselves, typically in a traditional type of wedding vow, that are very crucial. Things like, especially in weddings that were a few years back, the ones that when we got married and people our age got married and even the generation after us, almost always were things said like, lawfully wedded. Do you take this person to be your lawfully wedded husband, lawfully wedded wife? There's an intent behind that phrase and the idea of the commitment and the covenant and all that goes with that and the legality that goes with it, so that you understand you're entering into something where you are legally bound. Now, obviously we know we live in a culture where that means very little now. But to a Christian, it certainly ought to continue to mean a great deal. We say things like to have and to hold. That was one of the phrases that was used in our wedding. I've heard it in a lot of others. Do you promise to take this person to be lawfully wedded, to have and to hold? In other words, to be a part of your life, but to hold close. There's a word that we'll look at in Genesis chapter 2 in a few minutes that helps us to understand that concept of what that means, to have and to hold. But what about things within the wedding and within the vows that would indicate the idea of change? Can you think of any vows that you took that would automatically, inherently within them, contain the idea that there may or will be change in the relationship? Yeah, I mean, think about the statements that are made regarding in sickness and in health, for richer or for poorer. We say things of that nature, for better or for worse. You know, it's not difficult to think in terms of the good side of that. One minister was talking about, he said it was the strangest thing that he had ever experienced. He didn't know how to respond. He was doing a wedding ceremony, and he asked that very question to the young man. Do you take this woman to be your wife for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health? The young man paused just a second, and he said, yes, no, yes, no, no, yes. It's not six different questions. God's intent in marriage, we know from Genesis chapter 2, his desire for a marriage relationship is that we be joined together, and he says, and that we become one flesh. That's his desire. He wants a complete unity, a blending. Jesus used that term frequently in the New Testament as he prayed for his disciples. He talked about he and the Father being one, and praying that the disciples would also be one with each other and be one with him, and making them one with the Father. There's a unity there, a complete unified direction, a purpose in life, all that goes with that. This idea of being becoming one flesh contains the intimacy side of marriage and the sexual union in marriage, but that's not the full content of that. The oneness goes much deeper than that. A new entity exists. When I do premarital counseling, I talk about how those people who are getting married need to start thinking in terms of changing their vocabulary. And it's not so much I anymore, it's always we. The marriage is the new entity. That God says that you leave father and mother and you're joined to, and we'll look at that passage in a moment, but you're joined to in order that you can become this one flesh. But then what about another vow? You ever think about what is intended and what is meant? Along with this part of a typical wedding ceremony, many times the statement was made, do you promise to love this woman or to love this man from this day forward? Have you heard that expression in a wedding? From this day forward. We were married in 1977. It's the year that Elvis died. I encourage you, if you want to remember things like anniversaries, pick important dates, that allow you to remember those things. We were married in 1977. We've been married for 40 years. This was our 40th year of marriage. When it passed in May of this year, that was our 40th anniversary. There have been significant changes throughout a 40-year period. When you first get married, this concept and the concept of having and holding and the concept of permanent binding is easy. the day you get married. Why? Why is it so easy to think in terms of, I can't imagine not being bound to this person? What goes through your mind? The day you get married, what is it that makes you feel what you feel?
You're in love.
You're in love. You don't even know what that means yet, but you're in love, don't you? I ask people sometimes, are you more committed now to your marriage relationship than you were the day you got married? Now, before you shake your heads, I'm just going to let you know that's a trick question, so don't do this, because I would tell you, then shame on you. You should have been totally committed to your spouse the day you got married. Would you agree with that? The same as the day we came to Jesus Christ. He was looking for us to be totally committed. But if I were to rephrase that question and say, how many of you understand what that commitment means better now than you did the day you got married? Then we would acknowledge that, wouldn't we? There are things that I understand so much more about being married now than I did the day that I got married, but the infatuation and the love was there. There are four phases typically of a marriage that stays intact. This is just according to the social scientists, but there's four phases. First is romantic love. We understand that. That whole dating process, everybody, it's like a dance, one person said. You're always putting your best foot forward. You know, you're always doing things with the focus on the other person. But it doesn't take long. How many of you would say you learned something about your spouse after you got married that you didn't know before you got married? Anybody else? Now, here's a more crucial question. How many of you would say you learned something about yourself after you got married that you didn't know before you got married? Yeah, things aren't exactly as we think they are. I remember Gary Thomas in his book, Sacred Marriage, talked about that. He said he got voted most polite kid in the, I think it was the ninth grade. He was voted most polite. You know how they do those awards. I think I got least studious or something like that. But most polite kid, and he said, I thought it was a fair award. That's what he said. I was a polite kid. He said, I treated people well. He said, I seemed to react well to the things that happened around me. He says, and then I got married. He says, and I found out something. You remember ice cube trays? Nobody has ice. You know, I know this is probably hard for you younger guys to understand this, but the ice didn't used to come out of the door. You had to open the refrigerator and break a tray of ice apart and put it in your glass manually. And before those days, you remember you had to crank the metal handle on it. It wasn't even a plastic one that you could bend. And he said, he asked his wife one day, how much do you love me? She said, I love you with all my heart. He said, I told her, I don't need that much. I only need 7 seconds of love. He said, because I had timed it. That's how long it took to refill the ice cube tray and put it back in the freezer. She apparently had a tendency to, you had somebody in your household that was that way probably, didn't you? Use the ice, didn't refill the tray. But he said, had I really become so petty? Yes, I had. It isn't that he had become so petty. He realized there were some impatiences in him that weren't tested before, and now they're tested. Marriage will test a lot of things. There's that romantic love, but then there's reality. They say you go from the romantic love to the stage of reality. That's where expectations meet up with what is actually true, and so we have to reevaluate. That doesn't mean you bail on a marriage. It's just saying that you realize there is some effort required. There's some work required in a marriage relationship, in a family relationship. We mentioned yesterday in the raising of children, how many of you would say there were things that were much tougher in raising my children than I thought they would be? You know, the things that I had already determined ahead of time for my children. My child will never do this. Guess what? Child's going to let you know you're not as accurate at predicting as you think you are, Dad. You know, they do those things. Some things don't go just the way that you planned. Expectations meet reality. Then there's transformation. And whether you make it from this phase into the next phase is really the key as to what happens to a marriage. When do you think most marriages sever in this country? Average length of marriage that ends in divorce is how long? Seven is really close. And it used to be seven. It's actually up to eight. So, you know, we're doing much better as a culture. Average marriage lasting 8 years. Why? Because that's the point when most people, somewhere between 5 and 8 years, is when you go from romantic love to reality. It's kind of like when the new car smell wears off, but the payment is still there. Been there? You still have to make the payment, but it doesn't have the same natural attraction, but you still continue to pay on it because you need the car. Marriage is that way. Am I going to make that transformation? Because if I do, then I can make it into the next phase, which is mature love. That's the love that if you can make it past the phase of transformation, mature love is the love that has the ability to deal with change in marriage and has the ability to deal with issues in marriage and conflict in marriage. Average length of a marriage ends in divorce is 8 years. What is the percentage of divorce in our country of marriages? What do you normally hear? 50%, and it's still about the same. Here's how it breaks down. 41% of first marriages end in divorce. So it isn't 50% of all people that get married the first time. Only 41% get divorced that get married in the first time. 60% of second marriages end in divorce. 73% of all third marriages end in divorce. In America, there's a divorce every 36 seconds. Is that frightening? You know what that equates to? That equates to like 876,000 a year divorces. Now, a lot of those are second and third marriages that are divorcing and fourth and fifth marriages, or if you're somebody like a Zsa Zsa Gabor, you know, it's 8 and 9 and 10 or whatever it is. We went to our 10-year reunion, my high school reunion. They gave an award to the person most times married. Who wants to receive that? 10-year reunion. 4 times at our 10-year reunion. She'd been married 4 times. So we see that that's happening with this incredible regularity. People that live together increase the chance of divorcing by 40%. We live in this culture that says, you know, that's how you're going to solve that. Figure each other out. We're going to find out it's not about the chemistry that exists and making sure that you figure everything out. What we're going to see is that marriage requires something from us. And if we're going to be able to deal with it, then we need to understand. You ever heard anybody say that marriage is like a marathon? I mean, it's a long term. I would tell you it's more like a decathlon. Just as much effort required. But it's changing events. My wife's had 3 husbands. All of them are me. The man that I was when she married me at 23. No, I was 22. I turned 23 2 weeks later. That was a totally different man than I was when I was 30. And that was a different man than I was when I was 40. I don't react to all the same things. I don't have the same issues. I don't think the same way. The processes are different. We understand that. It's like a decathlon. Things are changing repeatedly in marriage, and we have to learn. So how do I cope with that? Because if day one in year 40 was the same as day one with the romantic, infatuated love, there would be no issues. Mainly because we'd be ignorant of them as more than we had dealt with them. But there's no issues. But that romantic love will eventually fade. I'm saying just the emotional feeling, the infatuation. God would have us to be romantically in love with one another throughout our entire marriage. But the infatuation that starts the process has to grow into something deeper than that. When your first child was born, somebody tell me what you felt when the first child was born and you got to hold that baby in your arms. What'd you feel?
A little scary.
Yeah, it is scary, isn't it? Yeah, all of a sudden, there's a fear that exists. That's one of the emotions you go through. That maybe not what hadn't been there before. All of a sudden, I'm responsible. I had a good friend who said, I don't know if we're going to have children. Don't know if I even want to bring children into this world the way that this world is. So that fear is there. I don't think that's a great solution, at least not for society as a whole if we all made that choice. But other emotions that you go through.
Pride.
What's that?
Pride.
Yeah.
Proud.
Yeah, pride. Now, not in a bad sense, like biblical, that I'm boasting. You know, you ever have anybody, you're walking your little baby in a stroller or something, and somebody stops you and says, oh, wow, what a beautiful baby. Our typical response is what? What's our typical response?
Thank you.
I do good work. That's a great opportunity to praise God when somebody does say that. You know, don't take the credit yourself. You know, we have been wonderfully blessed by God is a much better answer than thank you. You know, looks just like his father. That's why he's so attractive. But you know, as we think in terms of the emotion, it's not a pride and a boastfulness, but it's a genuine happiness. It's that kind of excitement. I am so thrilled by this. How many of you would say there were times in your child's life you were less thrilled? Did you ever go there? Did you stop loving them? No, you loved them in a different way. The love had to be deeper, because if the love that I had for my child didn't grow deeper, we would have had trouble much later in their life, especially when they became teenagers. It's like, wow, that would have been very difficult. Because you have challenges. The love has to be deeper. It has to be more patient. It has to have a great deal of forgiveness to it. And that's what we find out. We feel all those emotions, but we have to learn to grow. And marriage is that way. And we learn that marriage is a process. It's a process. We're working through it. And if I want my marriage to last a lifetime, then I'm going to have to know how to adapt it to the days that I am in. Because what made my marriage good and happy at age 23, things had to be altered because things had altered in my life when I was 40. Would you agree with that? Love had to grow. It becomes deeper. There are other issues to deal with. Excuse me, and that's true of marriage. And so we have to have a strategy that changes. I read an article just recently on change in strategy for warfare for the America. It was based on these different generals in the army and different branches of service writing strategy for what they call urban warfare. We've heard about urban warfare on TV, haven't we? I mean, the first Gulf War, it was like, boom, it was over, wasn't it? We just bomb everything, you go in and you take over and you kick people out of power. Then all of a sudden we find ourselves in Afghanistan and we find ourselves in Iraq still, and they're fighting, but they're no longer just being able to blanketly do those kinds of things. They're fighting in the streets, and that totally changes things. And the general said, we had to change our body armor. People weren't shooting at us the same direction they were before. They used to have body armor that had very little, if no, protection on the sides at all. They had to go to body armor that changed. They had to go to strategies that were different, where they were looking for the enemy, how they were going to engage the enemy, all of that. Why? They will tell you why. They said, our strategy has changed because the circumstances have changed. We understand that, don't we? How many of you would say you change strategies in business because society around you changes the way they do things? Is that not necessary? Well, I would tell you, you've got to have an ever-changing, adapting, mobile strategy in marriage as well. And it's going to take you back to the same point every time. But it has to be aware that the things around you are changing, and so I have to see them in that light. And marriage is constantly changing. It changes in circumstances, it changes in our emotions, it changes in our attitudes, changes in our actions. There are all kinds of changes in marriage. Tell me some of the things that change in marriage.
Health.
Absolutely. And so does that force you to deal with things differently than you might have before? Give me an example how health would force you to deal with something differently. Anybody? Oh, go ahead, Larry, and then I'll go, David.
The need to care for one another could be total.
Yeah, I mean, when we got married, and both in good health, it took very little time for me to care for my wife, or my wife to care for me physically. Now, we needed to be devoting much time to caring for each other emotionally and all the other ways spiritually, but physically, we didn't have any great demanding needs. But as you, and we're fortunate right now as far as health, but how many marriages have you seen where somebody had a significant change in health and it dramatically changed what the other person was going to have to do? Does that create stress on the person?
Yes.
I mean, stress can be handled. It's not like stress automatically ruins you, but it's stress. And you have to understand that now there's been stress added to the marriage. David, what were you going to say? Okay. And so what about other things besides health? Other things that change in marriage?
Finances.
Finances change in marriage. Sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad, and I would tell you both of them bring stress into the situation, don't they? You ever watch anybody because their finances changed so well for the good that it affected their relationship and their spirituality? Sure, that happens. You ever watch anybody that finances happened to the bad and it affected their relationship and their spirituality? Absolutely. The fact that there is change creates stress. Other things. Oh, family. And we're going to come back to that one in a minute because that is absolutely crucial to this discussion. I'm sorry, other things? I'm sorry, what? Yeah, absolutely. Time available. And family will have a great effect on that as well, won't they? I didn't make the point yesterday I intended to, that we've been convinced sometimes by our culture that our children need to be able to play 3 sports, 2 musical instruments, take dance and karate. And I'm just telling you, society has absolutely snowed you if you think that's necessary. And that's going to occupy so much of your time with your children that you'll have no time for your marriage relationship, and you're going to find that is extremely detrimental. The amount of second-half empty-nest marriages that end in divorce is just remarkable. People that make it 25 years and then walk away because they have no relationship with each other, that's indicative of a child-driven relationship. Other things, besides time available, there's time issues. Romance changes, passion changes. Now, things cause that. I've never met a married couple that says, you know what, yeah, after we had 3 toddlers running around the house, our time for romance and intimacy just increased by leaps and bounds. Doesn't happen. Those things sometimes fall by the wayside. Responsibilities change. Our connectedness change. Our hopes, our dreams. There's all kinds of things that change. Some for the good, some for the bad. Things that we control, things that we don't control. Some of them you can control, some of them you can't. Give me an example of something that changes in marriage that could put stress on the marriage that is totally under your control. Yeah. Who it is I choose to spend my time with. That's my choice, and that can put a stress on marriage. No question about that. Others? Recreational activities. What I'm choosing to do with my spare time, my extra time. I used to think taking your wife to watch you play softball was quality time together. I found out not necessarily true. The spouse helps you understand many things that you thought were true, not to be so true. But how we're spending our recreational activity time. How about where we live? We may choose to move. These are stress. They're called marital intruders. They're not all bad necessarily, but they all create stress, all therefore creating change. And so what we want to look at is, as you think about the seasons of change, in other words, not seasons as in I'm in the beginning of marriage, that's the spring, and then I'm moving on until I get into the old age of marriage. I'm saying emotionally, structurally, the marriage goes through seasons. Times when it's very, very easy and times when it is tougher because of the circumstances. Because of, if somebody has major health issues, but those health issues go away, it goes back to much like it may have been before. They can go through good seasons and bad seasons. Spring is when you first get married. That's the romantic, infatuated love season. It doesn't have to be only when you get married. But I'm saying that's when you say, you know what, we are just enamored with each other. That's the mentality that's normally where marriages start, but they can come back to there if we work at that. Summer is where very strong, everything's in bloom, everything's in warm, everything's just warm in the marriage. Things are going extremely well. So spring or summer, either one, as far as thinking of them as a season of marriage, are great places to be. Fall and winter, not so much so. And so what changes are going to allow us to get to fall or winter? Because winter marriages are the ones that sever. Fall marriages are the ones that lead to winter marriages, which are the marriages that sever. How do I deal and what strategy do I use to make sure I don't slip from summer into fall? Because the danger of being in the time when everything is comfortable and warm and good, what's the danger there in summer? Complacency. You remember, that's exactly what Paul told the Corinthians, wasn't it? Regarding the idea of complacency. He says, you think you're standing good? You think everything's going well? You think you're strong? He says, I'm telling you, beware. Because it's a short step from there to a fall, isn't it? Summer can breed complacency. And so we've got to make sure, what am I going to do to keep from going into summer or from summer into fall? And so here's going to be the goal in all this. And then we're going to look at a couple passages that I think are key to accomplishing this. The challenge is to regain and maintain balance in a marriage. Family is the example we're going to use because that's the one that at least most logically addresses the concept of how many things are affected by marriage. When children come into a marriage, they have an incredible effect on the marriage. Good and challenging. Would you agree with that? I don't want to say good and bad. We can let them get bad, but they're good, and I don't care how good they are, they're still challenging, no question about that. Children will completely and permanently have an effect on our marriage. Not always a bad effect, but I'm saying the fact that they are there automatically creates a different situation. Changes in time, we talked about that. Changes in intimacy. Changes in finance. All of these come about even with one child. Bring two children into the equation or three children into the equation, and it just gets more and more critical. So what are some of the emotions when marriages start to cool off? What are some of the emotions that go with that, do you think? Some of the emotions and some of the actions that go with that. Marriages that are starting to cool off. Marriages that don't have the fervor that they once had. What kind of things come to mind?
Blame.
What's that?
Blame.
Oh, no question. Blame, which is probably an action driven by an attitude, isn't it? An action driven by an attitude, which is always interesting. Nehemiah is one of my favorite Bible characters. Because they went to Nehemiah and they said, hey, Nehemiah, the wall around Jerusalem is just falling down. City's in big time trouble. Big trouble. How often had Nehemiah been to Jerusalem? Never. Born and raised in captivity. And so he can't be responsible for what's going on. Would you agree? And yet when you watch Nehemiah's prayer, his prayer to God is, I and my fathers have sinned. We're in the condition we're in because we're at fault. Nehemiah wasn't interested in blame. Nehemiah said, we got a big problem. We got to figure out how to solve the problem. You've got to have the right attitude as far as that's concerned. Other things. I mean, think of the fear and the sadness that goes along with marriages that are cooling off. Anybody ever talk to someone and they've just expressed concern? My husband and I, or my wife and I, we're growing farther apart. That scares me. There's a sadness that is there. There's an apprehension. Sometimes there's an emotion of rejection of the other person, or feeling rejection. There are attitudes of uncertainty and the detachment that is felt. And then there's going to be one word that tells us how we got from summer into fall. And God warns us about this word more than once in the Scriptures. And so how is it that I'm going to make sure? Because we've been married 40 years. When I meet with young couples for premarital counseling, I tell them, in my opinion, we've had 40 years of fabulous marriage. It's been incredibly blessed, 40 years of that marriage. So am I guaranteed that if we're permitted to have another 20 years of marriage, that the next 20 are going to go well? Not a chance. I'm going to have to understand that comes as a result normally of something, and I'm going to have to understand as things are going to change. Judy has a father who presently is 93 years old, just moved out of his house that he built in 1959 to move into a facility. It's an independent apartment, so he still takes care of himself, but it's one of those facilities where if you have to move to where you can get some assistance, you can move to where you get assistance, and those things change. My mom went through that a couple of years ago before she passed away. And I can tell you that changes things financially and a lot of other ways. When all of a sudden you go from living in an apartment that costs, or in a mobile home that costs very little, and you go into an apartment and they're saying, it's not bad here, it's only, what was hers, $2,700 a month, I think, something like that. And if she has to move over into the next side, it goes from $2,700 to $7,200 a month. You think that doesn't affect the children? Financially, it affects the children. As you're watching your mother at that stage of life, and you're having to make more trips from where you are to where she is, and you're trying to talk to your mother who's got Alzheimer's and she's starting to fade, and those kind, you think that doesn't have an effect on the way you feel and the things that you're doing? There's no way to affect me without it having some effect on my wife. No way to affect her without having some effect on me. Those things change in marriage. The guarantee is not there. And so what you have to do is you're going to have to figure out, how am I going to respond to change? Here's a bad response. And that's the one that's going to take you from summer into fall. It's just that we're just neglecting what we need to be doing for the marriage. Children can cause that even way before you get to this late stage of life. All of a sudden, I can stop neglecting or start neglecting my wife and not dedicating the time to her that I need to devote because of all the time that they're devoting to the children, or vice versa. She could be devoting so much time to the children that she's not devoting time to me. Look at some of the practical sides of that. The amount of people, I tell young couples now, the amount of young couples that I've talked to that allow the children to come in and sleep regularly with the adults, the parents in bed, is not a good thing for the marriage relationship. The child may love that, but that's not a great thing for the marriage relationship, especially because men view the bedroom differently than women view the bedroom. For them, it is a sanctity. It is where he is intimate with his wife, and that becomes a disturbance, and that causes stress. And now the children are infringing on time that they shouldn't be infringing on. You have to take care of them during the daytime. There are just things of that nature. That doesn't mean it's biblically wrong. I'm just saying we sometimes add stress to ourselves that way. And so we start neglecting the relationship. How important is that? The church at Ephesus was characterized by what? Revelation chapter 2. What's the church at Ephesus? How would you characterize that? You remember what they were told? Also, let's start there, because we normally focus on the negative comment, don't we? This is a good church in some respects. Would you agree with that? He said, you know what? You're faithful. I understand that. You don't tolerate some things that you shouldn't tolerate. And I like that. That's good about you. You're strong that way. You've got these good characteristics, but he says, nevertheless, he lists these wonderful things about them. Nevertheless, so think about a marriage, you know, and you say, this is good. The children are so good. They're so good with the children. They devote so much time to the children. They take care of their finances well. But if the statement is a but statement, a nevertheless statement, what's the most important part of a statement that has that conjunction in it? But. What's that?
But.
It's the but and what follows. You know, if I say, you know what, we've been over at David and Melissa's house for a couple of days, I'm telling you, they are just a wonderful couple, but... Oh, Larry's wanting me to finish that statement. He wants that information. I mean, what I said before the but doesn't even really matter, does it? You're waiting for what's going to come later. That's what the church at Ephesus was told. Nevertheless, you have lost your first love. The drive that is there that's causing all of this. That which sustains the relationship between you and God is not there. Does anybody remember what he tells them to do? So he's going to give the three R's, not reading, writing, arithmetic. He's going to give them some instruction. He says, so what do you do when you neglect? He says, here's the solution. He says, first, remember. That's what he tells them first. He says, remember where you were. How important is that? You ever go back and just think about your wedding day and the ceremony and or some of the things early on in your marriage that just excited you? And you know, you think back, and you know, some people, I do this on some occasions, and they're going, yeah, last week was beautiful. Well, last week wasn't for me. It was 40 years ago. So it takes a little more memory sometimes. But do you ever go back and reflect? He said, remember where you were. Think about that. I tell Christians that regularly. Can you remember when you came up out of the waters of baptism? What you felt like? When you were cleansed? When you were starting this brand new life with God? Reflect on that. Remember that. You remember when Peter writes, he says, sometimes people are short-sighted. They have myopia. They can no longer see that. He says they need to see that. They need to see when they became a Christian. We need to remember what it was like when we were young and in love and infatuated with one another, when it mattered to me and I would do anything to please my wife. Because it doesn't always just naturally happen. The house we lived in Kansas City had three levels. The family room was kind of down a half a level from the kitchen. You've seen those types of houses, split level type house. I got up one time from family room to go fix me a drink and get me a little snack. We were watching some TV. And I'm sure we were probably watching something that she wanted to watch, like a football game. So, but I went up and got me a little snack and closed the cabinet, got my drink, closed the refrigerator. I'm just ready to walk downstairs. And she says, while you're up there, would you get me a drink? I didn't say anything at all. All I did was go, ugh. Next line I heard was, you know I can see you. I hadn't gotten out of line of sight. But when you're very first married, wouldn't there be much more, you know, you'd have a Chick-fil-A attitude, wouldn't you? Would you get me something? It'd be my pleasure. You know, I'd love nothing more than to get you something to drink. What can I do to serve you? What was it like for that infatuation? He says, remember what it was like when you were first married to Jesus Christ. That's what he's telling him. Remember what that was like. And then he says, once you remember that, he says, then you need to repent. Because that's not what it's like now. He's not saying, just start over. He's saying, repent. Acknowledge that you've made a mistake, that you haven't put forth the effort. Couples need to do that if they're getting into that period of neglect, going from fall into winter. We need to be willing to say, I've not been living up to what I should be living up to, and I'm apologizing to you for that. I've not been the husband that I should be, and I apologize. I haven't taken you out in 6 months, and I apologize for that. Whatever the case is. Or the wife responding to the husband the same way. He's saying, repent. Decide and acknowledge that you're going to do something different. And he says, and then after you repent, do what? He says, reproduce the things you did at the first. What was it that made you feel that way in the beginning? He says, do it again. Do it again. That's what he's telling the church at Ephesus. He says, go back. He says, do those things you did at the first. He says, because that's what got you there. That's what'll get you there again. You see what he's saying? It's all a focus issue for us. He's saying, get back to understanding what it is that caused all the elation to begin with and do that. But then he uses a different word in Genesis chapter 2, a great word. He uses the idea of pursuing your spouse. What he says is, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and what? Cleave, which was always an interesting word. That's in the old King James says cleave. That was always an interesting word because it has dual meaning, doesn't it? Cleave can mean to divide in half. In other words, like a cleaver. Or it can mean hold together closely. The word literally carries the idea of being in pursuit of something. In other words, it's not just that I'm going to hold it close. I'm never going to let it go. That's that vow to have and to hold that I take. And so I'm going to cling to that person, some of the versions say. I'm going to pursue them. That's what you did when you were dating, wasn't it? Pursue. He's saying, don't stop pursuing just because you get married. Pursuit is what allows you to stay in summer or stay in springtime of wedding rather than going the other direction. The secret is not in chemistry, it is work. I had somebody ask me, can you present a lesson on finding your soulmate? I'll just tell you on the front end, as far as I'm concerned, you don't have a soulmate. Not one. It's not like God's picked out one person and you've got to find that person because that chemistry is going to be what makes it work. God's looking to find two people who are dedicated to Him, who will dedicate themselves to each other, and He says, I'll make that work. We did a marriage seminar where we had a couple there that had an arranged marriage. They'd been married for over 25 years. I'd never even met anybody with an arranged marriage. They'd come from India. Had never met prior to the day of their wedding. They were both Christians. They've been married now 25 years. You think that doesn't come with challenges? Well, it comes with challenges, and they talked about it. But you think their marriage was working? Their marriage was working. Why? Because they were pursuing each other every single day, because that's what God told them to do. We need to do that. And then finally, What about the winter? One word is going to take you from the fall into the winter. That's rigidity. That's when I'm more interested in myself than I am the other person. It's when I stop listening to what they're saying. I stop being concerned about what they are concerned about. I'm not doing the things that they need to have done for them. I'm more interested in myself. I get rigid. Does that make sense? That word for that application? I get rigid in the marriage. Two biggest causes of problems in marriage, I think, are in fact selfishness, number one, ignorance, number two. Sometimes we just don't know what we're supposed to do. But I'm telling you, ignorance is easy to solve. All you have to do is learn. Selfishness, not so easy. We get in the way of ourselves a lot of times. We get rigid. We don't accept the other person. And he's going to tell us there's one solution to that. And that's empathy. It says of Jesus Christ, he became a high priest. And why is he such a good high priest to us? Do you remember what the writer of Hebrews said? What makes him such a good high priest? It says he was tempted in all points, even like we. That's what makes him such a good high priest. What I feel, he knows. Not because he's God. He knows because he experienced life. That's why he came to earth. That's a part of the reasoning that he could connect with us on a whole different level. It was obviously to save man, but now he knows us differently, and that's what it says. He knows us differently. That's why he can sympathize and empathize with us. That's why when he rides the donkey and he's looking at Jerusalem, that's why he says he just starts crying. Shoulder shaking, sobbing, and crying. That was the picture of Jesus as he looks at Jerusalem. Not the quiet weeping like at the grave of Lazarus. He was broken down because the nation was going to be lost. He hurt because he knew that they were hurting and going to be hurt. We've got to understand, we have to have empathy in our relationship. Everywhere you read about Jesus, the statement is made over and over and over again that he saw the people and he was what? What did he feel? He felt compassion. God says we need to rejoice with those that rejoice, weep with those that weep. That's everybody. But if that's true of all of us as brothers and sisters, how in tune with my wife's emotions and feelings should I be? Should it even be possible that she could be suffering pain and I don't suffer pain? Should it even be possible that she's experiencing great joy and I don't experience joy? Or great concern and I don't experience concern? He's saying, I'm telling you, you've got to forget yourself if you want to stay out of the winter of marriage. Because things change. And there will be times when it wants your life wants to demand you focusing on you, and you're going to have to fight that urge. You focus on somebody else. I appreciate your attention, your comments this morning. If you've got any questions, not for right now because we're out of time, but if you've got any questions you want to bring up and bring to me individually, I'd be happy to do that. And again, this I hope this doesn't sound like shameless advertising, but brethren don't focus on this a lot, the practical side of these marriage things. We conduct marriage seminars about once a year. Next one's not till 2018, but if you're ever interested in any of those, just talk to me. We get 50 couples together that just spend 2.5 days dedicating their time to saying, how can we grow stronger in our marriage relationship? We don't even talk about family. Children are not a part of the equation. Those are just so we can focus on each other. If you ever want to know about that, just ask me. Be happy to share that information with you. Thanks for your attention this morning.